This is the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast.
Uh-oh, it's everyone's favorite time of the week. It's the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. And coincidentally, I am the Catholic Movie Guy. I'm here and I'm near to my brother, the Tin Man, as usual.
Hey, Wayne.
Tim's going to be quiet while I give my spiel up front here. Thank you if you're listening to this. Somehow you happened upon it. Maybe it's fate. Maybe it's providence if you believe in that. I do.
I believe the ancients called it fatum.
Did the ancients say anything about talking a little louder into the microphone?
Sibilance. Sibilance.
So anyway, thank you for acquiring this podcast by whatever means were necessary. Hashtag Malcolm X. And I would just say, please subscribe if you would. Review it. 5 stars. Go follow me on Twitter at CathMovieGuy. Follow my Facebook page and like it. Like it 6 or 7 times. Create fake Facebook accounts to like it more times. Create fake Twitter accounts to follow it more.
Like Father Spadaro.
Yes. Very relevant. Very relevant. So, we're here today to talk about a great movie and a great Catholic movie. We don't always focus on Catholic movies, as critics of our Burn After Reading podcast will attest. Got a little feedback on that one.
And a movie about a great Catholic.
Yeah, indeed. And Mark will like this movie, too.
Yes, this is Mark approved.
Yes, and the movie this week is A Man for All Seasons, the great 1966 Academy Award winner. What a time that was to be alive.
Yeah, the fact that that could win an Academy Award says something about our great land.
Indeed. And we're going to talk about it because it's 50 years, man. That's a good run. And it hasn't aged poorly. In fact, it gets better with age. I just watched it again last night. I don't know how many times I've seen it, but it never fails to resonate. And particularly in our times, as I'm sure we'll get to.
Can I tell you something about my education? How long ago I went to college at a public institution where in my ethics class we were required to watch A Man for All Seasons.
That's great. We did watch it in my Catholic high school, at least part of it as well, which is good. St. Pius X, shout out.
Today that same college would throw condoms out from the stage for incoming freshmen, so it's a little different.
And that anecdote comes from my freshman orientation. So, yeah, absolutely true. Nevertheless, we're going to go ahead and settle in and talk about it. But before we talk, I wanted to warn the audience. Because normally you're dealing with the Tin Man, who's already a bit of an eccentric, a bit of a bloviator. Well, you're a dynamo, certainly. Yeah. You're the star of the show. But today we're not just getting the Tin Man, we're getting the Bourbon Tin Man.
I like you, the Bourbon.
He's had 2? 3?
No. Of course, 3 would be sinful. I have had 2. I'm in the midst sinful. Of my second bourbon.
And that's 124?
It is a great 4 Roses single barrel proof. It is fantastic.
Yeah, so forewarned is forearmed, as they say. Tim, Man for All Seasons, I'm sure you like it. Just a preliminary thought. Well, plot summary, I don't think anyone needs it. If you haven't seen this movie, you need to stop the podcast and go get it right now and watch it tonight. You cannot die without having seen the movie.
Okay, plot is, it is a very faithful movie presentation of the Robert Bolt stage play, which itself I think is considered to be a very true-to-life account of St. Thomas More.
Okay, have you ever read Utopia?
I have.
Well, you know, I did not, from what I've read, I just didn't like it.
That's a philosophical treatise. It's also, I think, a bit of a lark. It had nothing to do with the man. Well, that's not true. I mean,
was it has nothing to do with this movie. No, but was it completely ironic?
No, I think that he was trying to show 2 things, what utopia would be and why it isn't possible, and thus why it shouldn't be attempted.
That was a total sidetrack.
That's 3 things.
Also, seek out his refutation of Luther, which is fantastic, the name of Henry VIII, comes up in the movie.
I actually quoted that on one of the blogs I write for, which is he was talking about Luther's preoccupation with the product of the rear end.
stlouiscatholic.blogspot.com if you want to read about that. But for all you Puritan types out there, he wasn't afraid to employ the potty mouth in defense of the faith at all.
Yeah, no, he's fantastic. He's a real man, and he's a real lawyer, right. and a good lawyer.
And I should also say he's near and dear to our hearts because we are lawyers, and I have a picture of him above my office desk as we speak.
Both of us, through independent means, ironically, have this lawyer's prayer from St. Thomas More.
Yeah, the exact same prayer and So, you know, I can't claim to be unbiased as to going in. I wanted to love the movie, but it's just a 10 out of 10 classic. So you've seen the movie how many times?
Many. Call it 10.
Well, we'll call it 10, but do you have any idea, really?
About
is it
10. 3? About 10. You know, I'm not on the yeah. witness stand. that is my best guess.
All right. Can you recall the first time you watched it?
Yeah, it was in college.
Okay.
For my ethics class.
And how did you feel about it that time?
Well, even back then in my slacker days, I knew that the Catholic Church was true. And to be able to watch a movie which celebrated a Catholic who stood up for the truth at great cost to, you know, truthiness to power, as the slackers would say now, it was really terrific.
So that's what struck me about it, watching it last night, was obviously in 1966, we all know what was going on in that era. Not that the church was necessarily ascendant still, but it was, you know, obviously more of a worldly...
It was. It was just beginning to fall apart, really.
Right. That's what I mean. That's why I said it wasn't ascendant necessarily. But it was at the
peak.
And
it was just beginning to court the world.
Peak of worldly influence without sacrificing for that influence, I would say, or whatever. But anyway, watching it today, just seeing how respectfully the church and Thomas More was treated. I mean, if you made that movie today, even if you were faithful, there would have to be more of a critique of the church, but there really isn't. He is completely 100% pure and great. Which
see, that's the difference between character development. The modern director would have him be a flawed character, but
exactly.
Critique of the church. The church, I gotta say, in this particular instance, deserved zero critique. That would not make it any different.
I know, but today, in order to be fair, what being fair really means isn't being accurate. It's being bad equally to all sides. And in this case, he didn't deserve that critique and he didn't get it, which is great.
Right, but I think you're... keep in mind, though, that, I mean, Robert Shaw was terrific as Henry VIII, and you see the vitality of Henry VIII, the persuasion of him, the dashing nature, the vainglory... But you also see that he desperately wanted Moore's esteem because he knew Moore was a man of quality.
Yes.
And they were fair to Henry VIII. They gave him credit for every natural virtue, if you will. The desire to be accepted and loved. He thought he had this higher goal. I mean, they gave him full credit on that side. They didn't ding the church, but I don't think the church should have been dinged or danged.
Danged, yeah.
Donged.
That's the Oxford.
Whatever. The point being, Henry VIII comes off as well as Henry VIII can. And Robert Shaw, in the midst of his friendly visit to Moore's home in the middle of the movie, is so menacing in his friendship. It's really very, very impressive.
I mean, if you were being a modern psychologist, you would say he's classic bipolar or manic. I mean,
bipolar and passive aggressive.
I don't know about that, but yeah, I mean, he goes 180, 180, 180, 180, and it's so convincingly portrayed. He's a man who's, you know, who's portrayed and probably accurately as being catered to his whole life, but he's smart enough and emotionally receptive enough to understand that has damaged him and how good. He needs the approval of a truly good person and a truly intelligent person.
Right, and he actually has a guilty conscience.
Yeah.
His conscience was, at that time anyway, still operative.
And he tries, even to more, to assuage his conscience in the terms of a Catholic.
And then he tells him, "Didn't I tell you, man, I would leave you out of it?" But even that, in the end, wasn't good enough.
Okay, and so we have on the one hand, Henry VIII, who's a flawed and ultimately a villain in the movie, but with redeeming qualities, and
you can see what comes to the fore. You see what a waste it was.
Okay, if there's a criticism to be had of this movie, in my opinion, and I am not, you know, I'm not Dr. Joe, our friend, I'm not a medieval historian, okay? If there's a critique, is it that Cromwell is a pure villain? I mean, really, if there is a good aspect to him, it's not shown in the movie. Is there something we're missing?
Oh, there's good there. There's intelligence and cleverness. It's diabolical. Cromwell is portrayed exactly as he should be. He has the devil's tool.
He has no idealism whatsoever.
No.
He's a pure instrument of acquiring power.
He wants power.
Yeah.
He gets power. He doesn't care who gets in the way. The Richard Rich character is a wonderful study of how people fall. in some ways, I mean, Rich knows that he's a villain. Rich knows that he's sacrificing his soul for worldly goods. The wonderful and you know, everybody knows the line, you know, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world for his soul, but whales, you know, it's fantastic. But Henry VIII comes off much better. He, in his work, he's like a giant child with a tantrum. Now, if I can make a modern day gloss on this, the whole idea of easy annulment, this is what confuses our non-Catholic friends, because it sure looks arbitrary. And in the historical case of Henry VIII, he needed a dispensation to marry his brother's wife. They had I think that's stupid, but they had a much different idea of what
it was the law at the time.
Right. So he got the dispensation.
Right.
And he followed the rules. And then when he wanted to get another favor, he just figured he'd get another favor.
And of course, this is Catholicism 101, but there's a difference between an ecclesiastical law that's not natural law based.
Disciplinary.
Right. And one that is, which is validity. The reality of marriage. Right.
Laceity and validity. But you can see why to a more simple mind it appears arbitrary.
Absolutely. And I wanted to tie that into today. We can't possibly have this discussion without reflecting on our current Holy Father's decisions in the realm of annulments and of admission of the divorced and remarried to communion without saying...
You mean Francis.
Right.
Okay.
What I'm saying is it's very difficult to explain to well-meaning church-going Catholics, people in our family, people that go to Mass every Sunday, the fine distinctions here. We had a conversation earlier today with a common family member who I will not name, obviously. I'm not going to put him on blast, as the kids say.
What does that mean?
I'm not going to dish on him in the streets.
Does it mean throw shade?
No. Well, if I put him on blast, it could be to throw shade on him or for some other reason.
Pitching.
Right. But I don't want to be salty about it.
All
right. I'm just saying... I'm not going to put him out there. I'm not going to.
All right.
I'm not going to tell who it is. Nevertheless, right. Who is arguing basically that you should get a do-over on the first marriage? You're young, you know. And this is what to the world.
And this is a guy who's 30 years into his first marriage.
Who's a faithfully married, church-going Catholic, every week going Catholic.
Well,
the point being, how are we to defend such difficult concepts when it seems like we're being undercut? Not only by the difficulty of the concepts themselves, but by the leaders in the church. The movie, it could not be more appropriate for
Here's how. Okay, owing to the Englishness of the movie and the fact that we got Henry VIII involved, let me quote C.S. Lewis, non-Catholic Anglican, for this proposition. He pointed out that obviously people don't think anymore. They feel. They're not argued by intellectual propositions into a position. If they were, you could do this. It's a lot like trying to explain why the Latin Mass had never been abrogated. However, in practical terms, to answer your question, is you cannot do it.
You can't. You really can't.
The well is so poisoned. You are just looking like an idiot.
And in our case, with all due respect to his office, one of the greatest obstacles to that is the Holy Father, because
today,
under the best possible light, he's not vociferously defending what we all know to be the common practice and historical teaching.
You don't have to stretch that far. That's not the best. The best possible option is that he hasn't attacked it enough to be definitive, because he's attacked it. So right.
Well, we'll agree to let that one slide. But you know, in this movie, Wolsey, Cardinal Wolsey, is the
totally
villain
corrupt
who is trying to convince Moore to support the petition.
Right. And he's Catholic. He's a cardinal. And he's the number one, the Chancellor of England. Plus, he's the Primate of England.
Right. But even he, on his deathbed, recants. And
he regrets.
He regrets. Well, hell, some of us.
Oh, Berman Tim's the problem, isn't it?
Some of us, all we can do is regret. You know? I mean, that it's imperfect contrition, right. But it's contrition all the same. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
And that's a great scene when Norfolk comes to take the Chancellor's necklace.
Duke of Norfolk, great. Oh, here, my gosh. Great. But my point is, and that's a cardinal, that's a high-ranking official, making Moore's life very difficult.
Yeah.
What if it was Moore against the Pope?
Right. And that's what it is today, because, you know, Moore is, I mean, obviously, St. John Fisher, St. Thomas Moore, you're looking at Burke and the four cardinals, and anybody of us who stands against him. Thomas Moore, at the time he died, was seen as an enemy of the greater England or the king or whatever, but even the lowly Protestant admired him, respected him to some degree, and saw him as a powerful adversary. They gave him credit for his convictions, which they may have thought wrong or may have thought politically inconvenient. When we do this today, I can see us all going to our deaths, and we're not going to be respected. We're just going to be complete idiots.
And they're going to kill us anyway. Well, I'm sure that deep in the recesses of their nefarious hearts, our enemies will respect it on some level. But I do, in this movie, Cromwell, as much as he is a pure villain, he respects more. He's a worthy adversary.
It just doesn't affect his decision making.
No, but more confounds him again and again, and he respects that on a worldly level, even though he can't possibly understand
it. In the end, he is confounded on every level by Moore and still wins and still knows
he'll win. Well, and again, we're Catholic. He wins to the ways of the world, but obviously he loses ultimately.
Okay, plot spoiler.
There is no spoiler in this. It's a 50-year-old movie based on a historical event.
When he's on trial, he clearly shows that Rich perjures himself. There's not a doubt in anybody's mind. There's not a doubt in Cromwell's mind. There's not a doubt in the court's mind. And Cromwell doesn't even let them deliberate so they have a chance of doing the right thing, which they had zero chance of doing. Because England, I apologize to my English friends, they have a history of caving on the faith. And that's a problem.
That's so funny that you say that, because two times at least in the movie is repeated by different characters. When Moore expresses what he's going to suffer because of his decision, they say, "This isn't Spain, this is England."
Right.
And no, it can never happen. We're all about common law and freedom and blah, blah, blah.
That's so cool. Because it's very ironic, because they saw the Spanish as these casuists, you know, exactly. The Jesuits. And by the way, these are the good Jesuits.
Mm-hmm. All right. The real Jesuits.
The real Jesuits before they were, you know, ixed and before reconstituted.
Before they sold out the hit singles and whatnot.
Right, right. Of course, hits. Right. Yeah. They're nothing but hit singles.
They're just climbing up the Billboard charts. Exactly. You know what I'm saying?
I don't understand that.
What I'm saying is they're playing to the cheap seats and they ain't bringing the heat. You know what I'm saying?
Not at all.
What I'm saying is they're compromising their principles. And that's a problem, you know what I'm saying?
That didn't even rhyme! Okay.
Rhyme principles, it's difficult.
Smensingles? And we're back!
And we're back!
Okay, so what was I saying? Oh, you were blathering about Jesuit. The Spanish of the casuistry when it's the English. Man, you know, don't get me started. I have an English friend who would be very appalled to hear me say these things, but he's Catholic, so it's okay.
Yeah, you know, I guess I differ with you. I do enjoy the common law tradition of England. But yeah, in this instance, it just shows that when you want power and property and to do what you want with your libido, you'll do whatever you need to do.
The only thing I could fault Thomas More for in this movie is that when he was asked about this oath, all he had to do was blame Russian hackers. And he could have gotten out of the whole thing.
Very, very funny. Poignant.
Russians hacked the oath.
I love when you bring current events to the podcast. Love it.
Podcast. That'll age
well. That'll definitely age. Yes. Like a fine Four Roses single barrel strength bourbon.
It's barrel strength that's important, people. It's not just the
normal
single
barrel.
We're going to
go ahead and recommend the 8.5-year barrel, not the 9.5. Not that it's not great, it is, but I'm going to go 8.5.
Every barrel's different. You never know until you try it.
It's like choosing a favorite child. Clearly, you have your favorite child and you choose them very easily. That's what I'm trying to say.
Of course. But you can never admit it.
Right. So back to the oath. As a lawyer, I enjoy also the fact that, you know, obviously it would be great and in a certain sense more perfect to seek out martyrdom or to embrace it when it's presented to you. But he says basically the business of man is in escaping, which, you know, it's kind of comforting when you're not one to seek out martyrdom unnecessarily.
This is why I like Moore, because I think it is sinful to seek out martyrdom. That's why the business of man is in escaping. God gave us our wits.
Whoa.
If you can escape with honor, to seek out martyrdom is rash. It's presumptuous.
Bro, have you ever read The Lives of the Saints?
If you listen to Moore in this film, he condemns that proposition exactly in his speech on escaping.
Well, one of the things that I love about Catholicism is that it allows for many different types of saints, as many as there are different types of people, okay?
But if you seek out martyrdom, that's a kind of suicide.
Dude, there are innumerable. I mean, of course they are innumerable. But there are, you know, hundreds, thousands of saints that, according to our hagiography.
Hagiography?
Hagiography.
Hagiography.
There's many accepted pronunciations in the dictionary. According to our martyrology.
Martyrology?
Sought out martyrdom.
Right. Absolutely sought it out. They wanted it, but to...
Not just wanted it, but even put themselves in position to get it and got it and succeeded.
I ain't never seen it.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you, but I think...
I agree with me.
I think what he's really condemning, in my view, is you don't have to seek it out. Not that you can't, but that you don't have to.
And there is zero sin or dishonor in not seeking it out. I think in some ways...
Of course, but there are also levels of perfection in wanting it and seeking it.
I've always been of the Moore school because my
impulse...
I think
you're misstating his school is what I'm saying.
Okay, maybe. But to me, this is me personally. I have an impetuous personality. I like the dramatic gesture. Running towards martyrdom is something that appeals to me as an ideal. But if I tried to do it, I wonder if I would sacrifice that grace you need to survive it, or if I would become one of these pathetic losers who recants.
Well, that's a very big statement of you. I'll just go ahead and say I'm of the Moore school because I don't particularly relish early death.
Right. But to me, if you know, I mean, the opposite of the so-called Muslim martyr, where you get to kill people and go to heaven, you just lose on every level. But to stand up and make this grand statement for God is a great thing. It is a temptation. It can be a temptation of pride. And Moore eschewed that in order to suffer. White martyrdom all the way for Moore. Only martyrdom when he had no escape.
I appreciate that read. That would not be my read on his actions. My read would be he didn't relish being a martyr, and he sought to avoid it, and he did so for as long as he could, but accepted it gladly when he couldn't. Nevertheless, I do think that in these real characters in this movie, we see archetypes kind of responses to questions that call for persecution or martyrdom. You see Henry, who is torn, clearly, but ultimately will capitulate to what he wants.
He's got
to
get his.
Right. You see the Duke of Norfolk, who is not at all torn. He's totally ready to give in. He doesn't even see what everybody's upset about.
Oh, I disagree.
That's what he says in the movie. He says, just say the oath, Thomas.
No. Norfolk stands for the proposition because he's a good guy. He agrees at 100%.
Why is he good?
He starts out as a good guy. He would totally agree with Moore. Totally, 100%. And if you ask him even after the fact intellectually who's right, he knows it's Moore. But he sees it as, well, if I do that, I'm going to get killed, so I'm going to give in, but I can still believe in my heart the right thing and just give in on the surface.
I agree everything you said, and that to me makes him the most detestable of these characters. He knows he's wrong, and he does it anyway.
He's not the most detestable because he's not an affirmative agent of Satan. Yes,
okay,
he's a coward.
But he's a coward.
But he knows what's right. He never fools himself into thinking he's doing the right thing.
But that's my point, is that's why he's detestable. He's
I can see that point of view.
He's disgusting because he knows what's right and does against it anyway. Cromwell is more evil in a certain sense because
evil.
He's passionate about his evil. But he's also more respectable because he's not lukewarm. He likes what he's doing, and he's doing it for power.
I think he is 100% despicable and 0% redeemable. He is a complete beepwad.
You understand my point, certainly, right?
I mean, I don't agree with it. I don't like Cromwell at all. He is the most evil man in the film.
Me either, but at least he's honest about his evil. He's
can't
out there.
Be honest
the Duke
about
of
evil.
Whatever, man. I don't know how to continue this line of thought. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and move on. And then you have Moore, who's a hero, but still seeks to avoid
the
martyrdom.
The most detestable person, way more than Cromwell. I get your point about Cromwell. He has no bones about it. He doesn't agonize over it. That's just what he does.
Right.
Richard Ridge is the most detestable person of all.
Yeah, okay.
Norfolk tries,
I don't even consider him.
Tries in his mind... In his spiritual friendship with Moore, or in the little things he tries to do for Moore, he thinks he's doing something. Richard Rich, Moore is his benefactor, and he turns on him. That is Ninth Circle of Hell stuff.
Okay, but you do see throughout the film that Moore does treat him with a bit of contempt, a justifiable contempt, or a tough love.
Yeah, well, yeah, and contempt in the best sense of the word, in the technical sense. But he... By doing so, he shows him what he is and gives him the... He offers him again and again honest work commensurate with his skill, and the guy won't take it. To the end, he doesn't send him away from his family. He knows the guy's gaining information on him. He knows the guy's working against him, and he still maintains a relationship in case the guy repents. It is a very charitable act by Moore all the way till the end.
Yeah. Another character that I do love is Roper, who is very passionate and I mean, I just enjoy that character.
And he's a good-looking guy. He's kind of hot.
The Catholic Movie Guy Podcast is a family program.
Okay.
Mr. Saucy.
He just kind of reminded me a little bit.
I'm hovering, and you don't want to do it because I'm not ready. I have one more point to make.
Okay.
At least.
Go ahead.
Of my many, 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 many points.
Okay.
I want to talk about the scene in the tower. So old Thomas is stuck in the tower. He's withering away. He's aging. His family gets to visit him one last time, ostensibly to visit, but really to convince him to take the oath. Of course, he refuses. He's the hero. He's a saint. He's a martyr. But that scene where his wife is kind of an Elizabeth, or not a Mrs. Bennet character from Pride and Prejudice. Like she's clearly not as intelligent as he is. She's clearly more worldly than he is. She's kind of a ditz.
She's not silly like Mrs. Bennet, but she is dim.
She's a bit ditzy in the picture. I just love that she's kind of like, why are you making me do this? Come home and let's have a cup of tea or whatever. And then at the end, she embraces him. She knows that he's doing what's right. She respects him and she loves him, and with a love that is not mere sentiment, but a deep longing for what is best for him and what is best in serving God. And that scene where they embrace, I cried last night. I cry every time. It's beautiful, and it's a welcome antidote to what it's a welcome antidote to what love is presented as in 2016.
And flip the script.
Because in 2016, this would be a loveless marriage.
No, because what I love about it too is that everything you said is right, and I agree with you 100%. It's a very touching scene. Think about it from the opposite perspective. How can a guy of that intelligence, social standing, ever love this woman?
Yeah.
She's totally beneath him in every natural
level. In every worldly sense.
In the natural graces. Right. But boy, her love is strong, and he saw it.
Yeah, he sees it.
They are a wonderful match. Yes. The daughter is just like him. Mm-hmm. But that wife
exactly.
She's a piece of work in a good way.
And that's, his affection for his daughter is beautiful too in its own way, but it's totally understandable. His affection for his wife comes from a supernatural understanding of marriage. Love it. Great, great picture. And you know what else, Tim? I don't know if you knew this. You know my wife.
Should I say her name?
No.
Okay.
Not because I don't want you to, but because I respect her privacy.
Oh, privacy.
Yeah.
Privacy.
My wife has seen this movie.
Yeah?
Sometimes I wonder, what did my wife think of the movie?
I don't know.
You want to find out?
I suppose we could. Did his wife like it?
Hello?
How you doing?
Hi.
It's me.
Hi, it's you.
I'm here with Tim. He's on speaker with you.
Hey, Wayne.
Hello.
Hi. We wanted to know, you ever heard of that movie, Man for All Seasons?
Who hasn't?
Have you seen that movie?
Yes, yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I happen to know with moral certainty that you fell asleep during it last night.
Well, I...
Isn't that true, Mrs.?
I remember loving it the first time I watched it. I just happened to be really tired.
Well, you're never going to be the Catholic movie gal if you fall asleep during A Man for All Seasons. I can tell you that.
Sorry to disappoint.
You don't disappoint me. I love you.
Love you.
Okay, bye, Shmoopy. Bye. Well, that was that. What'd you think of that?
That was astounding.
Disturbing?
No.
Disgusting.
Shmoopy's very, very Seinfeldy.
Yeah. Shmoopy.
I like it.
Yeah. It's kind of nice, right?
Yeah.
All right. So any parting thoughts on this film, this picture?
You've obviously already seen it or you wouldn't be listening to this podcast, but if for some reason you haven't...
This what?
Podcast.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, go see it. It is one of the great movies of all time.
It's a certified 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
Classic.
There's not a bad scene in it.
Well, Tim, if you're going to give it 10, give it 10.
Tim Man, yeah!
I'll assume that was 10 without counting. Are there any other movies you would give 10 out of 10?
Well, there's always the great Metropolitan.
And we will see you next week on the Catholic Movie Guy podcast. We're going to be doing something wonderful, some sort of a collage of the movies of the year, perhaps. I don't know. We'll see. Something great before Christmas, because you got to have something to send you into that holiday week in style. So with that in mind, I'm out of here.
See you, Wade.
If you like the music, it's called Waste Technology by Jazar, betterwithmusic.com. Check him out. Until next time, I am the Catholic Movie Guy.